Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And maybe you've heard the breaking debate news by now. An NPR poll released this morning has qualified Michael Bloomberg for tomorrow night's Democratic primary debate. The former mayor needed 10% support in the poll. He got 19% nationally, putting him second only to Bernie Sanders, who topped the field at 31%. That's news in its own right. Sanders now cresting over 30% of Democrats nationally. Another poll out this morning has Bloomberg in a statistical three-way tie for first in the Super Tuesday state of Virginia. He and Sanders and Biden were all around 20% within the margin of error. So later in the program, we will talk to President Obama's former White House communications director, Dan Pfeiffer, who you may also know from Pod Save America, that podcast, about the national picture. And we'll talk to New York Times columnist Jamel Bowie, who lives in Charlottesville, about Virginia. Dan Pfeiffer and Jamel Bowie coming up. We'll begin today by talking about two very important criminal cases now at crucial stages here in New York. The Harvey Weinstein rape and sexual assault trial is going to the jury this morning, now that closing arguments have been completed in the case. Did the state prove that the sexual contact between the powerful movie mogul and his accusers was not consensual? And over the weekend, a 14-year-old boy was arrested and charged with the murder of Barnard College student Tessa Majors in Morningside Park near the Barnard campus. What kind of process will bring the most justice for the victim and her devastated family, and also for the accused minor, given what we know about the exonerated Central Park Five and other such injustices? With us to talk about both cases is WNYC's legal editor and All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd. Hi, Jamie. Thanks for starting your day early.
Good morning, Brian.
Let's take the Tessa Majors murder case first. The suspect allegedly stabbed her to death when she resisted his attempt to rob her in the park. Why did it take 2 months to arrest and charge someone? I think they had the idea that they knew who this was right from the start.
Right. So I want to say, Brian, now that this case is ramping up, first and foremost, that it is a terribly tragic case. We have a dead college freshman. We have a grieving family. And we also have to remember, as we talk about the case, we must remember that these suspects are children. This is a 14-year-old boy who has now been charged. The other suspect is 13, and we'll get to that, I'm sure.
That's right.
And they are presumed innocent until they are proven guilty. Presumed innocent, I must say over and over again, because as much as that is the bedrock of our system, you and I both know, Brian, that once these cases start to kick up in the criminal justice system, that presumption begins to fade away and the presumption of guilt starts to take hold in the media and in the courtroom. So why did it take so long? Well, I think the long shadow of the Central Park Five case, the case of a woman who was not murdered but very nearly was killed in Central Park 30 years ago, and five boys were arrested, black and brown boys arrested, and spent between 6 and 14 years in prison for a crime they did not commit. Teenagers, young people, 14 years old themselves. One was close to 16 years old. The long arm of that injustice it haunts the city and haunts this case and some other cases that we've talked about, Chanel Lewis. So I think law enforcement is aware of that. And so they wanted to, they say, and I believe, get more evidence in front of the investigative team before they arrested this second boy. Now, they had the 13-year-old boy make a statement, they say. I always say they say. Mm-hmm. All of the information we get as journalists in the early days of these cases comes from where? NYPD.
Yep.
And the district attorney's office. So they say now they have a statement from the 13-year-old boy. They say they have a statement from the 14-year-old boy. But they also claim, Brian, that they have DNA recovered from one of Tessa Major's fingernail clippings. They say they have video evidence. So that's what they say they're working with. Again, I hesitate to even put that out there because then we reinforce the law enforcement narrative. But they were waiting. First, they had to find the second boy. That took some time. And then once they found him and interviewed him, and there's a third boy, by the way, another 14-year-old who has not been detained in connection with the case, but they say they wanted to cross the T's and dot the I's before charging this second boy as an adult.
So this 14-year-old, to pick up on what you said right there at the end, will be tried as an adult, according to the DA. What are the options for the district attorney in this case, and is it clear why he's making this decision?
To charge as an adult?
Correct.
Right. Okay. So everyone then asked the obvious question, what about raise the age? Don't we charge...
That's a law that passed just last year.
Yes, just last year we raised the age of criminal responsibility to 18 after years of processing teenagers as adult. And so what raise the age means, Brian, is that 16 and 17-year-olds who are arrested and charged with nonviolent crimes have their cases heard in family court. And they receive, and this is from the law, quote, intervention and evidence-based treatment. But, Brian, in the case of teenagers who commit violent crimes, even if they're under 16, prosecutors have the discretion to try them as adults. So simply put, under New York state law, juveniles charged with intentional murder can still be tried as adults. And so in this case, with the 14-year-old, whom they suspect is responsible for the actual stabbing, they've charged him as an adult. The 13-year-old is not charged as an adult because they suspect he was involved in the robbery. And so what they've charged him with is felony murder related to the robbery. He's also only 13. And in the eyes of the district attorney, and you've heard Commissioner Shea several times reference his very young age, 13 years old. So he will be tried in family court.
Can you explain that charge a little more for a second? The 13-year-old charged with, as you just said, what they called felony murder, felony murder.
It's a very controversial thing, felony
even
murder.
Even though he was accused of taking part in the robbery, but not the stabbing. So can you explain that charge of felony murder in this case?
Right. So, you know, the most, the way you learn about felony murder in law school is you and your cohorts decide you're going to rob a bank, right? You're driving the getaway car. They go in and rob the bank. You never have a plan to kill anyone, but it goes awry and someone or several people in the bank are killed. Your compatriots run out, they have the money, they jump in the car, and you drive off. You've never been in the bank. You had nothing to do with the killing. And yet you are charged with felony murder because you were part of the plan and conspiracy to rob the bank. And a murder happened in the course of the plan of which you were a part. And so you are, though not one of the shooters and not even one of the robbers, you were just driving the getaway car. And so now you are going to be charged with felony murder because the felony attendant to that killing, that murder, you were guilty of that. It's a very controversial area of law. Now, in this case, they are claiming that the 13-year-old was standing right there. He's not outside the park as a lookout. He's not in a getaway car. He's closer in time to what went wrong.
Involved in the robbery.
But he did not, according to the statements police say they have, do the actual stabbing. And so that's the felony murder rule.
On the 14-year-old.
And there's talk in New York, by the way, a lot of talk about doing away with the felony murder rule. That's a separate conversation for a separate day. Our reporter, Yasmin Khan, has been digging into that in the newsroom. It has been eliminated in some other states.
On the difference with the 14-year-old being charged as an adult, the difference in the process or the possible consequences between being tried as a juvenile and being tried as an adult in this case. Is it clear to you what they are?
Well, let's talk first about the juvenile. So he will be tried in family court where it's an entirely different place and procedure. And the attendant consequences are less. So that's quite simple and clear, right? The young man, the boy, essentially a 14-year-old. And I want to be clear for our listeners, we've made an editorial decision here at WNYC. We might as well just put it out there, transparency, right?
Right.
We've decided not to say the names of these young men because they are juveniles, and our policy here at our newsroom is not to name juvenile defenders, defendants. So that's why we are not saying their names.
Though some other news organizations, including the New York Times, are.
Well, the New York Times has made an interesting choice. They are not naming the 13-year-old going forward. They've said they will not, but they are now naming the 14-year-old since he has been charged as an adult. So they've moved into their adult policy, even though he is underage. That's an interesting choice. So the young man who is 14 and being charged as an adult will be tried in the youth court division of the criminal court, which is a separate division in the criminal courthouse. And what that means is the judges have some training in family court procedures and dealing with youthful offenders. So he's not in family court, but he's not in the big bad adult section of the criminal court. It's sort of a sliver of criminal court reserved for youthful offenders. So that's where he'll be.
And are the consequences different if we presume a conviction?
Yeah.
If he was charged as a juvenile?
We're looking at 15 years to life. I should very much emphasize that the U.S. Supreme Court has said not too long ago that juvenile offenders cannot be given life sentences or death sentences. We don't have that here in New York, so that's off the table. But it's a critically important thing to understand because that those opinions rested on the notion that young people do not have the same capacity to form intent that adults have. And therefore, we cannot punish them with the same level of consequence that we would punish an adult in this very same fact pattern if this had been an adult offender. And again, I'm presuming innocence here, but when we charge, try, and convict youthful offenders, we cannot, the Supreme Court said, give them life sentences. First, they had said no death penalties for young people. That was a clear and rather uncontroversial decision. Mm-hmm. But then when they said no LWOP, as we call it, life without parole for young offenders, that was slightly more controversial because some people think, well, if a young person does an adult crime, they should do adult time. But the Supreme Court said their brain, as we know, young people's brain, it's still developing. And the frontal cortex, all of that, until you're about 25, maybe even 28 years old, the court said. So those are very instructive decisions for this case.
Listeners, we're talking with our legal editor and All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd, about the two very important legal cases in the news today. Of course, there are so many important cases in the justice system. They don't always make the press. But today we have the arrest over the weekend of the 14-year-old in connection with the murder of Tessa Majors in Morningside Park. And we have the case of Harvey Weinstein going to the jury today after closing arguments were completed. In that case, we will get to the Harvey Weinstein trial in a second. And we can take a few questions for Jamie on either of these cases. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Before we move to Harvey Weinstein, one more thing about the 13-year-old who's charged in the Tessa Majors case. We started by talking about the echoes of the exonerated five, the Central Park Five, and law enforcement apparently trying to avoid some of the egregious errors that were made in that case 30 years ago. But the Legal Aid Society, which represents the 13-year-old, has argued in court hearings already that their client was subjected to aggressive interrogation tactics, including, quote, browbeating and screaming, unquote, with only the child's guardians present.
Yes, I'm glad
and
you're bringing this up.
Lawyers.
Yeah.
That's reminiscent.
Yes.
Is there a danger in using a confession from a minor when they may not have lawyers present, a danger in, you know, getting a false confession?
Yeah. I'm glad you're bringing this up. So our law says that when a young person is interrogated, he or she has the right to an attorney present or a legal guardian. I always say to any young person with whom I speak, ask for a lawyer. Yes, certainly you should have your guardian present, but ask for a lawyer. Anyone. I say that to anyone, not just a young person. Don't speak without an attorney present. And then once your lawyer shows up, they just tell you to shut up. Don't say anything. And I find it very enlightening to our system that the young boy who spoke with only a guardian present, it is reminiscent of the Central Park Five. He has been in custody ever since. And I want to point out also that our reporting here at WNYC, George Joseph, reported that one of the detectives on this case is Detective Wilfredo Acevedo. Now, he may no longer be on the case, but he was in those initial hours and days, and he has a decade-long problematic record at NYPD in terms of his tactics. So to put him on a case that involves such young suspects is deeply troubling to me, just as an analyst, not as a criminal defense attorney, to have a detective with questionable tactics and a questionable record in NYPD. Now, NYPD has said there is nothing wrong with Acevedo's record. We stand by him. But I hear what the attorneys are saying. He had this 13-year-old suspect had no attorney present and was subjected to deeply troubling interrogation methods, the young boy and his guardian say. And so that makes the statement that he gave or may have given, because sometimes the statements are more a creation of law enforcement and then the young person signs the statement, that makes it less legitimate. It undermines the work of NYPD in a case. Sometimes the overzealous nature of law enforcement to solve a case like this when there's tremendous pressure to do it, they can get in their own way.
And of course, as you started with, it's both a horrible tragedy and a brutal crime against an innocent college student and her loved ones, and a horrible tragedy for the accused killer and other accomplice and their loved ones if we see 13 and 14-year-olds as not fully formed and from different socioeconomic circumstances, even if guilty, even if they should have known right from wrong, in as obvious a thing as you don't rob somebody and you don't stab somebody.
Right.
So certainly to take nothing away from the suffering of the family of the victim
of
and the death of Tessa Majors.
We just don't want to compound her death with further injustice. And you know, when the Miller decision came down, the one I mentioned earlier from the U.S. Supreme Court about juveniles and life sentences, I will point out that at that time, more than 70% of juvenile lifers were people of color. 60% were African American. So there is, as we've discussed many, many times, great dysfunction in our system. Great dysfunction in our system when we are locking up young black and brown boys, an entire generation of them. And the U.S. Supreme Court, essentially an elitist institution, recognized the failure of the system with regard to these young people.
Let's move on to the Harvey Weinstein case. The jury will begin deliberations today. They will be deciding whether or not to convict Weinstein on 5 felony charges, including rape, criminal sexual assault, and predatory sexual assault, which carry a maximum sentence of life in prison. Weinstein's lead defense attorney in that case, Donna Rotuna, has been making the rounds in the media lately. Yesterday, she published an op-ed in Newsweek titled, "Jurors in My Client Harvey Weinstein's Case Must Look Past the Headlines," which maybe is a bit ironic if she's addressing the jurors in a headline news story. But remind us of the basics. Although more than 90 women have accused Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment or sexual misconduct, all the way up to rape, prosecutors in this case are relying solely on accusations from 2 accusers, Miriam Haley and Jessica Mann. Why only 2?
Right.
Remind us if there were so many accusations.
Right. Okay. So it is it's amazing to me that we finally come to this day where we may have a verdict in the Weinstein case, another deeply troubling case where, you know, no matter what we discuss, Brian, we have to remember the between 87 to 100 women who say that Weinstein either harassed them, assaulted them, or raped them, a whole range of sexual misconduct, which is the big umbrella term we use. In this case, the first question people ask is, why are there only two women complainants in this case, two women who pressed charges? There were more women who testified. And that's for a whole host of reasons, right? You had to be in the jurisdiction of Cyrus Vance, so that leaves a lot of women out. If we're talking London, Venice, Los Angeles,
Queens.
even Queens or Brooklyn, Cyrus Vance can't do anything about that. It has to be within the statute of limitations. And some of these cases, the allegation is that Weinstein's predation goes back decades. So if you're outside the statute of limitations, we could argue about statutes of limitations, but it has to be not too old a case. It has to be criminal in nature. So just harassment, even if it's brutish, awful, boorish behavior, that's not enough. So in the end, they winnowed it down to three cases, and then eventually one woman fell out of the case because of some messages she sent that compromised her ability to go forward in the case, the district attorney felt. And they ended up with these two cases in New York. And then four other women who testified to bolster the testimony of the two main complaining witnesses.
Now, a large part of the defense case rests on the assertion that each of the accusers at the center of this case not only had friendly communications with Weinstein mm-hmm. after the alleged sexual assaults, but also continued to have consensual sex with him
right.
afterwards at times. Here's a 44-second clip of his lawyer, Donna Rotunno, speaking on the New York Times podcast, The Daily.
I think, you know, these are consensual encounters. We have communications at the time that I believe prove that they were consensual encounters. I believe the actions of women after the fact prove that they were consensual encounters. When you look at real-time communications between two people, it really lends a very interesting spotlight into what was happening between two people at the time. And maybe the story being told today or in a courtroom is different. And I guess at the end of the day, it's going to be for the 12 people on the jury to decide based on the evidence if they can shut out everything else that they've heard, and hopefully they will make their decision based on the facts and the evidence that they hear in the courtroom.
Harvey Weinstein's attorney, Donna Rotunno, on the New York Times podcast, The Daily. Jamie, if what she's saying is factual and has been demonstrated in court, mm-hmm. how would those later consensual encounters inform a decision on whether a rape or other sexual assault was committed in a previous encounter?
All right, I want to be very careful as I explain this. Rape and sexual assault can happen in the context of a relationship. A wife can be raped, or a partner can be raped, a male partner can be raped in the context of a marriage, and then continue that relationship. Or boyfriend and girlfriend relationship, and continue that relationship. A prostitute can be raped. There are actually well-known cases that we study in law school when we're studying the concept of rape. So those are complicated cases, but it's to demonstrate to lawyers in their training that generally we're talking about a woman, not always, but generally, a woman can say no, whatever her status in the relationship. What is complicated here is that we are talking about a relationship, as wrenching as the testimony may be, a relationship that makes it very difficult for the prosecutor to meet the burden of proof, because they have to prove that Harvey Weinstein raped or sexually assaulted these women, meaning that the sexual encounters that they are talking about on the witness stand were without their consent, the specific ones they're talking about. And that is difficult when not only they didn't go to the police, police, which the jury might understand, but they then continue to communicate with Weinstein in an intimate fashion. One of the two complainants, probably the most significant complainant here, the most powerful one, she wept during her testimony. She described a very violent a rape by Weinstein, but then she continued to write about Weinstein in emails both to him and to others about a, quote, relationship with him, and admitted, as you just said, Brian, to having consensual sex with him after the alleged rape. It's not that it can't happen. The problem is that the prosecutor has an uphill battle convincing the jury that this very this is a very sophisticated thing that Giuliani is trying to convince the jury of. And it's just very, very nuanced. And you've got a jury of seven men. And women don't always go there with you either. Sometimes female jurors, only two of whom are white women, mm-hmm. they can be harder on female victims than the men, who can be protective of those victims. So I'm not saying he won't be convicted, but this is why people are very hard on Cy Vance for not bringing these cases. But this is why they are so rarely prosecuted, because once the victim gets up there, it's very difficult. If it's not a stranger rape where you're just yanked down by somebody you don't know mm-hmm. and raped, and then we can mm-hmm. find the guy mm-hmm. and then we can get the DNA, that's a different kind of case. These are very hard cases to prove because the nuance is so terribly complicated, and the defendant enjoys what we were just talking about it in the other case, mm-hmm. a presumption of innocence. The burden is on the prosecution. So with every piece of evidence, we presume Harvey Weinstein not guilty.
One other question about the law on this case before we take some phone calls, and all the phone calls that are coming in are on the Tessa Major suspects mm-hmm. and that case mm-hmm. as it's going forward. Can a so-called consensual encounter, if it's seen as coerced in the context of the movie business,
right,
be a sexual assault under the law? Because as I understand it, part of the defense's argument is that these were consensual encounters in some cases because the women knew that Harvey Weinstein might advance right. their careers as a result of engaging in this sex. But given his position of power over them, does that exonerate him or does that implicate him?
There is a jury instruction on coercive rape. In my experience, it is given only when someone is a police officer or a judge. So, for example, a police officer pulls you over. They're going to take you in for having drugs in the car. And in exchange for a sexual encounter, they release you. Then you can get a jury instruction if that ever goes to trial, which it most likely would not mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. this is a police officer. But that's coercive rape using the power of your office. I actually covered a big case in Los Angeles with a judge who would use his, believe it or not, office, his judicial office, with people who appeared in his court. That's coercive rape. I've never seen it in a case like this. I imagine they argued about that jury instruction, but I don't think the judge would give it because Harvey Weinstein, though powerful, was not a public official mm-hmm. with that kind of power. This is simply power in the movie business. And though many people care about the movie business, listen, people, it's not the same as whether or not I'm going to prison. It's just the movie business.
And with our legal editor and all things considered host, Jamie Floyd, Canadian Harlem, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in. Hi.
Wow, so sorry. I'm walking into my house.
They're coming to get you just for calling.
I know, oh my God.
the high risk of calling the Brian Lehrer Show.
Hands up, don't shoot. Oh.
The sounds of New York City.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm inside now. Thank you. So, Brian, I've talked to you before. I have a show called Black Issues Issues where I talk to students, and I also have a show for adults talking about the intersection of blackness and law enforcement and mass incarceration, education, and everything. So I'm sure it wasn't your plan. I love your guest, by the way. The irony of how how the disparity of Weinstein's lawyer, group of lawyers can, you know, pretty much play chess in terms of defending him, cleaning him up, making him look vulnerable with the walker. And when it comes to black and brown youth, you know, there's no benefit of the doubt. There's no mercy. It's just, he did this, mm-hmm. lock him up for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it, you know, not to bring up slavery, but I'm going to bring up slavery.
Bring it up because it's relevant.
It's very relevant because if you look at the trajectory of our society, black people were always hyperly pathologized from inside of the womb. They did not have any agency. It was okay. This is your child. I can sell that child. I can keep. So it's constant. Blackness is constantly under the specter of a larger society, which inherently is not in any way, shape, or form invested in the humanity of blackness. And so that trickles down way into 2020 right now. What we're seeing that there's no fancy lawyers that can sit there and parse right. through the nuance and the sophistication of the case of these boys. And again, this has absolutely nothing to do with Tessa Majors. I go to Columbia University. I'm not as a student, but I lecture there often, and I used to have a fellowship, ironically, for community engagement there. So,
well, actually, I agree with everything you've said, but the last piece, because she is a young, attractive white victim. And we know from our history that when the black man, young or old, is charged in the case of a young white victim, and the statistics bear this out, then the power, the full weight and power of the state comes crashing down on that suspect. And if there is no suspect, they find a suspect, as they did in the Central Park case. But I couldn't agree with you more about the juxtaposition of these two cases. Mm-hmm. And you're right, we didn't plan it. But, you know, I started in this business on the O.J. Simpson case. And that case proved up the power of the dollar in the courtroom. O.J. Simpson, a black man, and he figured it out when he was charged with murder, because he was kind of confused before that. He proved to America that if you can match the state dollar for dollar, then you might beat your case. But most black and brown people, when they are charged with a crime, cannot do that. And poor white people, too, by the way. And what Harvey Weinstein is able to do, he comes in with white privilege. He comes in with all of the power of the dollar. He's able to amass a dream team. And so he can give the state a run for its money. And as we know from Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which I commend to any reader who has not seen it, the carceral state is an extension of Jim Crow and slavery. And we essentially, and I just pointed out that statistic, that the juvenile justice system is also, of course, comprised of black and brown boys. So I completely agree with everything you've said, but it's most starkly illustrated when we have a young white victim.
And thank you for your call, Kanani. Keep calling us. Myatt, you're on WNYC with Jamie Floyd. Hello, Myatt.
Good morning. Great show, Brian.
Thank you.
A two-parter, and I'll listen over the air. First, in the furor of the Central Park Five initially being charged, the New York State legislature, and they were mostly dominated by Republicans, passed a law that was brought out in a book, whose title and author I can't remember, but one of her themes was that even after the exoneration, that the way juveniles would be treated in terms charged as adults. I'd like Jamie to speak on that law, if she recalls, and whether it's been, it probably has not been changed. The second part is I'd like her to talk about who I remember first name Amber, a Philippine Italian actress associated with Weinstein, who went to the police and the DA was to help and wear a wire and got evidence, and right. That's a very extraordinary story because early on she got pushed aside. And Jamie, if you haven't understand my questions, I'll listen over the air.
Maya, thank you very much. And I think that last case you referred to, we played that tape on the air.
Amber Gutierrez.
To D.A. Vance. And
oh, did you?
He claimed that he just didn't have enough evidence, even with that, to bring a successful case. So here we are in reaction and somewhat to the to some degree to the publicity here and elsewhere around that story.
She was one of the original women who spoke with Ronan Farrow. And
reporting for The New Yorker.
Well, right. He was originally reporting for NBC when he got that tape.
Right.
And
they didn't
even with that tape, they didn't want to run it. And I commend, if you can either listen to his podcast, Catch and Kill. I know I shouldn't be promoting a podcast that isn't WNYC Studios.
Oh, we do it all the time.
But I'm doing it. So you can either read the book,
go
Catch and Kill.
Every podcast, but go
yes,
ahead.
Go podcast world. You can listen to the podcast, Catch and Kill. There's a whole episode on Ambra. Her name is actually Ambra. Rather than Amber, Ambra Gutierrez, and or you can read the chapter. And yes, very briefly, I commend you to do that if you're interested in her story, but she was very courageous to wear the wire. And then secondly, and she did take it to D.A. Vance, and the rest is mm-hmm. sort of history. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there was a tough on juveniles law that was passed in the wake of the Central Park Five, and there's quite a bit of good coverage on that in the New York Times. We're tight on time, so I can't get into a great deal of commentary about it, but I do want to say that juvenile violence and juvenile crime is down in New York. So this sort of sentiment after what's happened in Morningside Park, the fear factor, we shouldn't fall prey to it. Crime is down generally. Violent crime is also down generally. And juvenile crime is down, violent and nonviolent. And we've done a good bit of coverage of that here at WNYC, but you can also, if you want to look back to 1989 and what happened in the wake of the Central Park Five, the Times did a lot of reporting on that legislation that passed in the city. She is right about that.
On the teens accused in connection with the Tessa Majors murder in Morningside Park, and on the Harvey Weinstein trial, now going to the jury this morning, we thank WNYC legal editor and All Things Considered host in early today. We will hear you this afternoon on ATC, right?
4 o'clock.
Jamie Floyd, thank you so much.
My pleasure.